You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hello, chaps.
Hello. Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Bar Italia. 2 weeks running. Very hospitable hosts, they were, last week. And so we've come back.
They're getting into a little... It's becoming a ritual almost, isn't it? Lunch downstairs and then we retire upstairs to record the podcast.
Yeah, retire. If only there was somewhere for a little post-prandial nap, this would be the perfect recording venue.
Not great timing, though, because we're now going to do the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Daniel, how are you?
Not too bad, chaps. Not too bad.
Still in Mallorca?
Unspecified European location this week.
Excellent. Have you been watching a lot of racing?
Well, there's been a lot of racing. I must take issue, actually, with Napalm. I saw a slightly miserablest tweet from Napalm about
concomitants
of the two races, Paris-Nice and Tirreno, the other day.
Not like Lionel to tweet about cycling.
Napalm, I don't know what really can be done to... obviously the two races can be scheduled at different times. However, as far as the two races... finishing at the same time every day and people not being able to watch both finishes, I mean, you're in the lap of the sort of TV gods or the greater powers, who have got, you know, very important other programming to do, haven't you? You know, like Rex, the, I think it's a 1970s French soap opera about an Alsatian dog that has to go on at some point, and then there's something that comes after, and I'm sure Neighbours has to be fit in somewhere. I don't know, Home and Away.
Television.
I don't
know.
I haven't watched television for years, but you know, there are all sorts of important things that need to go on.
It wasn't a miserablest tweet at all. Actually, it was just a slight regret that on more days than was comfortable, the races Tirreno Adriatico in Italy and Paris-Nice in France finished more or less at the same time. And on Saturday, I've completely lost track of which days it was. No, it was Sunday, of course, wasn't it? The day that Astana riders won both races. It was.
That could be pretty much any day, isn't it, recently?
It was just unfortunate that they crossed the line more or less at exactly the same time.
Lionel, we all know you have two sheds. Do you not have two TV monitors that you can watch? Two satellite dishes? Two separate setups?
Well, I had one on the laptop, one on the office TV, yes. And as I'm sure lots of our listeners did, double screening, in fact, triple screening with the Ronde van Dronst on Women's World Tour race as well at the weekend. That was necessary for some. It's just not ideal, is it? It's, I'm not saying anything new here, am I? Saying that it's a shame that both races are scheduled so they finish at more or less the same time, meaning that you have to watch one on delay. And I tried a couple of times watching Paris-Nice on delay, and all because social media infects absolutely everything. Unfortunately, the results were spoiled for me by just the
get
fact
off social
that they
media.
Were known to the general public.
First world problems, these, aren't they? Anyway,
get
there
off
has
social
been...
media. Get a proper job that means you're not at home on a weekday afternoon, and you know, catch up later. Ask your friends who won.
People are never happy.
Wow! I mean, this is man of the earth, Daniel Freib, with some life hacks here. Then what next? What next?
Daniel's out foraging for food in the Majorcan forest or unspecified European forest. Anyway,
he's just been out and killed an avocado for supper.
There's been a lot of racing, and some other news has just landed as we hit record on our recorders, as exclusively revealed by the Cycling Podcast last week, of course.
Was that a scoop? Was it a scoop?
Well, I wish with hindsight I'd been a bit stronger. I did say that Ineos were set to take over Team Sky. I should have said that the deal had actually been done, contract signed, etc. So I should have gone a bit further. Should have been a bit stronger with that.
Were you trying to protect a trusted source?
Or? I might record it now and then insert it into last week's episode after the fact.
It had been rumoured
And take out that Geraint Thomas to BMC racing rumour from about 2014 while I'm at it.
Yeah, that was that's returned
Edvard Bolsenhagen as well.
That's returned to bite you on the backside, hasn't it, that erroneous rumour.
A few occasions.
But this one has turned out to be true, Rich. Team Sky will become Team Ineos sooner than perhaps we even imagined it. They will be rebranded in time for the Tour de Yorkshire at the start of May, and so therefore their first Grand Tour as Team Ineos will be the Giro, which starts the following weekend. We didn't go into detail about Ineos last week, but it's a company owned by Jim Ratcliffe, who is said to be Britain's richest man with a fortune of £21 billion. I'm never sure how the Sunday Times rich list and these other rich lists actually verify the information.
He can definitely afford to watch Paris-Nice and Tirreno at the same time, can't he?
Yes.
Must have multiple televisions.
Well, next year he's going to have a team in each of them, isn't he?
Mm.
I mean, yeah. Anyway, Ineos has previously sponsored Ben Ainsley's America's Cup team. That's boat racing, isn't it? Yachting.
£110 million he threw at that, I read.
Right,
so
yeah.
It's a lot of money to spend on his sports teams. And the rumours appear to be that, well, the budget Team Sky / Team Ineos could even go up from the reported $35 million or so that they're currently on. So they could, already the richest team in the sport, they could become an even wealthier team. There's more news to come, I'm told.
So what is Ineos? It's an energy and petrochemical group, one of the biggest in the world. It's partly involved in the controversial business of fracking. Jim Ratcliffe is reportedly a Brexiteer.
Oh, a right-hand gentleman from Watford. You should know that any point could be construed as political is not suitable for the podcast.
That was an intervention there from John Burko, I think.
I give friend way of the podcast, to the honourable
speaker
member of Coventry.
And it's member for Watford, isn't it? Rather than member from, I think. But anyway, we're getting into parliamentary.
No, fair point. His political views don't have any sway here. But the business does. If you remember back to the start of, was it last year, Daniel, your idea of the ethical report, looking at the ethics of, just giving credit where it's due, Daniel, looking at all of the World Tour team sponsors, maybe we need to think about this and provide some kind of update in the coming weeks. But it's an interesting segue, isn't it, for the team. Team Sky, of course, last year were very prominently displaying the message, the Ocean Rescue Campaign, one of Sky's initiatives. They had the Wales logo on the back of their jerseys at the Tour de France, and Pass on Plastic was a hashtag on the team's vehicles and jerseys. And so it's quite a different line of business that is, or a different message that is being promoted by the cycling team.
Yeah, Lionel, I mean, we can already, I think, sense in some of the reaction to the news of Team Ineos taking over from Team Sky. A lot of it is centering on what the new sponsor does. Natalie Bennett, former leader of the Green Party in the UK, has tweeted, "Extreme mismatch, a low-carbon, energy-efficient method of transport in cycling and proponent of fracking." She's added, "Although given both reputational issues, may be inevitable," talking there about Team Sky. That there has been quite a lot of reaction along those lines, and it's something we'll seek to speak to the team about at some point, I guess, how the sport of cycling and some of the campaigns that Team Sky have been involved with in the past kind of match with the business of the new sponsor.
I think it says everything about the transient nature of sponsorship in, well, all sports, but particularly professional cycling, where the teams are sponsored by a company and then they take on the name of that company. I wonder whether, I think Friends of the Earth have also issued a statement today. I wonder if Friends of the Earth or the former leader of the Green Party had anything to say about Orica when a mining company sponsored an Australian team. And on the point of cycling being a low carbon, energy efficient mode of transport, which of course it is, fantastic way to get around, the sport of professional cycling is very different. It's teams and riders are flying all around the world, all the team cars behind the race. I mean, it's
buses sitting with the generators on all day.
The generators on and burning, what, €600 worth of fuel in a day and a half.
Dumping their waste by the side of the road.
We've covered some of these issues in an episode of Kilometre Zero a while ago. I would say, just to re-mention the ethical report we did into the team sponsors, on one hand, it's up to everyone watching the sport to make their own mind up about which sponsors are palatable to them and which are not. But you can look at one sponsor of a team and look at another sponsor of a team and decide which ones are for you and which aren't. But the bottom line is, there is no equivalent of a kind of a fit and proper person test. There's no kind of no UCI rule regarding who can and can't sponsor a cycling team.
Maybe we'll get Daniel to the top 18 most ethical teams.
Maybe.
Well, there is a lot of discussion already about the new sponsor Ineos, but what are the implications of them taking over Team Sky for the team and the riders and the sport? Because this removes one of the stories that was set to dominate the season, namely that question of whether the uncertainty over Team Sky's future might affect them on the road. Would it mean that some riders would perhaps be riding for themselves rather than for the team? Would the unity that has carried them to so many Tour de France wins disappear? It has answered that question. The team does have stability and security, though there will doubtless be some changes next year, and we understand that there will be one or two important departures and doubtless arrivals as well. But it's pretty unusual for a team to change its name, its sponsor and its colours, if they do change their colours, mid-season. It happened in 1989, I've been looking this up, when Caja Rural became Paternina just before the Tour de France. It also happened again in 2006 when Operation Puerto erupted and Liberty Seguros became Astana. Also in 2008 when Slipstream became Garmin, and the same year when High Road became Columbia, also on the eve of the Tour, and a year later, again just before the Tour, when that same team, High Road or Columbia High Road, became HTC Columbia. But no team has ever changed its identity before the Tour de Yorkshire. So that's a first.
But Team Sky are not the only team that is finding a big backer from the world of petrochemicals, because Direct Energy, the French team, is also believed to become Team Total, or I think
Total.
It will be Total in French, obviously. Jean-René Bernardeau's Direct Energy team likely to be rebranded Total before Paris-Roubaix, according to L'Equipe, the newspaper in France. And Total is one of the world's big six energy companies. Oil companies, sorry. This is Nicky Terpstra's team, of course. They're not actually in the World Tour. But can any of you, either of you, quiz question, can you name all of the sponsors of Jean-René Bernardeau's team since they turned professional in 2000?
That's I would podcast. Say so, Napalm. In order, I'm not sure about in order, but I would say Brioche La Boulangère, Bonjour?
Yeah, Bonjour were first.
Bonjour were first, then Brioche La Boulangère, then Bouygues Telecom.
Yep.
Europe Car, Direct Energy, Total.
Yes, and I suppose if you counted B-Box, Bouygues Telecom after Bouygues Telecom. Anyway, voila. This is the team. Most famous riders would be Thomas Vauclair and Sylvain Chavanel. Another big deal, and I mean, that could be a real boost for Bernardeau's team, not in the immediate short term, but certainly for 2020 and beyond.
Yeah, another new major sponsor coming in, as you say, Lionel, and it's a team that has been threatened with going out of business at various points in the last few years when they've lost sponsors. But I mean, not dissimilar to a chemical company in Ineos, Total, petrol company, but not the same sort of discussion around their entry into the world of professional cycling, which is an interesting little inconsistency there, but perhaps not unexpected. I don't want to provoke John Berko again there in an unspecified European location. Anyway, let's go on to the racing,
shall
we?
Well, you make a good point.
But there's lots to... I mean, I'm sure we'll return to team sponsorship.
We drive a lot of kilometres in cars that burn fuel. We all have plastic bottles, don't we? I mean...
Come on, Charles, let's crack on. There are people listening who are just desperate. I've only tuned in to hear my top 18 riders. Top 18 most likely riders to win Milan-San Remo.
To save the planet.
They'll be switching off.
Yes, that's a good point. We do need to get onto Milan San Remo, so please crack on, Lionel.
Okay, well, the two big races, Paris-Nice and Tirreno-Adriatico, will be the subject of part one and two of this podcast today. But in very brief, Paris-Nice was won by Egan Bernal of Team Sky. The sixth Team Sky victory in Paris-Nice in 8 years by five different riders. Like I say, we will talk about that in part one of the podcast, Tirreno Adriatico, which is ongoing at the moment, the final time trial in part two, and our look ahead to Milan San Remo in part three. The Women's World Tour continued with the Ronde van der Ronde in the Netherlands, won by Marta Bastianelli of Italy, ahead of Dutch riders Chantal Black and Ellen van Dijk. That was Bastianelli following up her fourth place at Strada Bianca by getting her first World Tour race victory of the season. Andrea Taffi, the 1999 Paris-Roubaix winner, who had suggested that he might try and make an unlikely comeback at the age of 52, didn't seem to have got anywhere in his search for a team that would put him on the start line of Paris-Roubaix in Compiègne next month. But any chance of riding the race now over, because he crashed in a local race in Tuscany at the weekend and has fractured his collarbone. Some sad news from the world of British cycling. Keith Butler has passed away aged 80. He was a former national champion and part of the Great Britain team when Tom Simpson won the World Championships in 1965. He briefly rode for the San Rafael team with Jacques Anquetil, and he managed the Great Britain team at the 1986 World Championships in Colorado. But for anyone who's raced a bike in the south of England, almost certainly would have taken part in a Surrey League race, a really successful, almost a blueprint for amateur racing in the United Kingdom. Keith Butler was one of the people who set up the Surrey League in 1983. He passed away at the age of 80. The Tour de France has confirmed that the Grand Départ next year, well, we already knew it would start in Nice, but we now know that the first two stages will both start and finish in Nice, basically loops into the countryside. The first one, sprinter-friendly, 170-kilometre stage, finishing on the Promenade des Anglais, basically two small circuits of 50 kilometres and then a bigger circuit of 70 kilometres. So it's kind of a circuit race almost, goes through the finish line a couple of times. And then the second stage will feature the Col de la Colmiane, the Col de Torini, which we saw in Paris-Nice at the weekend, and the famous Col d'Aix, which used to be the traditional final time trial of Paris-Nice. And again, the race will go through the finish line. So there's a real kind of festival feel to the opening weekend of the 2020 Tour de France in Nice.
A lot of people talking about it being very unusual for there to be such a challenging stage so early on, but it's not really. I mean, the tour started in Nice in 1981 with a very similar stage, and Freddie Martins actually won a very short, hilly stage, even though he was more of a sprinter, but also San Sebastian when the tour started there. What year was that? 92, of course it was. And
and you had a climber in the yellow jersey almost straight away, didn't you? Richard Vrol.
There was a major, I remember Chiappucci, Bugno, all these guys were at the front right from the start. So quite a tantalising prospect.
And even Corsica in 2013 was pretty hilly, not on the first day, but certainly on days two and three.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Comfort and confidence is incredibly important. My name's Jimmy Whelan and I ride for EF Education First Pro Cycling. Obviously comfort comes first, but they also have to look good as well. And I think Rafa have nailed it this time around. The bib shorts in Australia reacted perfectly to the hot weather. In the brutal 50 degree temperatures, and I raced over 1,000 kilometres in a week with them, and they were perfect. The Rafa bib shorts are the best bib shorts in the world.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. Now, Rafa have just launched, or sorry, they're just about to launch their new shoes, the Classic and Explorer designs, which have been created entirely in-house following years of experience and research, tens of thousands of kilometres of wear testing, and it's a shoe, well, the Classic shoe has already been raced in the World Tour by the EF Education First testers. It's a full carbon sole on that shoe, coated in a thin and light no-slip hard-wearing rubber for moments off the bike. Lionel, you have a set of Rafa shoes, do you not?
I do. I've got the climber's shoe, which is somewhat ironic given my lack of ability when the road goes upwards. I think the shoes are helping that tiny bit.
Any little helps?
Every little helps, indeed. They're very, very comfortable, very light as well.
Good. Well, for more information on the new designs, that's the Classic and Explorer shoes, go to rafa.cc. Paris-Nice, actually, EF Education First had a very good Paris-Nice. They've started the year pretty well. Danny Martinez won that stage in Paris-Nice, which was very impressive to watch. A stage that was really dominated by the Colombian riders, but Egan Bernal, obviously that was the day that he moved Kwiatkowski out of the yellow jersey and sealed the overall win. What did we make of Paris-Nice? We're going to hear from Dave Brailsford in a moment. Our friend Francois Thomasot was there, and he spoke to Brailsford and also Bernal. But what did you make of it, Lionel?
Well, what I made of it really was Egan Bernal and Michał Kwiatkowski of Team Sky put themselves in a very strong position on the two crosswindy stages, which we talked about last week. I mean, we suspected as much that they were manoeuvring themselves into a position to challenge overall, and so it turned out. And Bernal is clearly a talent and a half, isn't he, to win the race by the margin he did. And it wasn't as if they weren't put under pressure, because Nairo Quintana had a real good go at trying to put Team Sky under pressure, but Team Sky had the strength to reel them in and clinch the overall race. And a pretty impressive performance from Bernal, without really having to sort of, he didn't have to kind of showboat or do
too much. It was almost like he just took his leg warmers off for the final couple of stages. He'd been in tights all week. Yeah. And in the crosswind stage, when he's really mixing it with some real specialists on that sort of terrain in those conditions, all 60 kilograms of him, that was unbelievably impressive. And the time trial as well underlined his kind of all-round strength. It's interesting watching him climb with Quintana, who he was the future once, to paraphrase a politician. David Cameron, that was, remember him. It's quite interesting to watch those two together, because you wonder what's going through their heads. Bernal leading Quintana. Quintana must have been like a god to him just a couple of years ago. And Quintana, meanwhile, once a god and sort of unchallenged as this, Daniel, you've called him a sort of deity in Colombian cycling. Now, not even the best Colombian cyclist, you would argue. And it's all pointing towards Italy and the Giro for Bernal.
Yeah, I think going into these two races, Tirreno and Paris-Nice, and thinking ahead to the Giro, a lot of people felt that Tom Dumoulin and Simon Yates were the outstanding contenders for the Giro. Maybe coming out of these two races, people will revise that and they'll think that Bernal and Roglic are the two riders who look certainly in the best form at the moment. And any thoughts or hopes that people might have had of the Sky hegemony being broken as far as stage racing is concerned were sort of dashed, weren't they, at Paris-Nice. They were very much in control. It's a sight we'd not really seen since, well, this season yet, of Sky completely dominating mountain stages in stage races. And they've added a couple of riders who look as though they're going to be worth their weight in gold, Sosa and Narvaez as well. They've got Walt Powell's riding very well at Tirreno, so it's all looking quite ominous from the point of view of Sky's opponents, I would say. Looking ahead to the major tours.
Yeah, I mean, they have a really good pedigree in Paris-Nice, don't they, going back to Bradley Wiggins 2012, and then Richie Porte twice, Geraint Thomas, Sergio Henao, and now Bernal. The other two riders who've won in that period, Betancourt and Marc Soler. Richard, when we were watching last week, Marc Soler of Movistar looks a real sort of pale imitation of the rider he was this time last year. But maybe that indicates that his goals have shifted back in the season a bit.
Yeah, I was really struck by, there was a crash on a stage we were watching last week where they were held up by a bridge, and Soler was caught behind that. And what struck me was that he just didn't seem to really care. He seemed to find it quite funny. And I just, something about his body language, his whole demeanour, he was obviously at that point sitting well back as well. Surprising, and he's still a young rider, and I don't really know what's happened to him or what's going on or whether he is training for the Vuelta or something much further down the line. We'd have to ask some of our Spanish colleagues about that, but I certainly didn't put up any kind of fight. When you list the names of the Sky winners, it's surprising that Chris Froome has never won Paris-Nice, but it has proved a very useful sort of stepping stone towards goals further down the road. We should hear from Dave Brailsford actually on that. Let's hear first a little bit from Egan Bernal, and he was speaking to Francois Thomazeau after the time trial. Then we'll hear a bit from him reflecting on winning the race and looking ahead to the Giro. Then we'll hear Francois in conversation with Dave Brailsford.
Obviously, Team Sky's ambition is to win this Paris-Nice, but is it going to be Michal or yourself, or would you be happy with winning on the Turini, for instance?
Yeah, for sure, but I think our first goal is to win. And Chiatto is our leader, so we will try to win the race. For sure, to win one stage is good, but it's most important to win the race, and we will not risk all the GC just for one stage, you know. So we will keep in mind to win the GC, and we will try our best.
It's really big to think about to win the Giro. It's a big thing. It's one of the most important races, so I prefer to not think about this. I just want to prepare it well, and if I win, it's good, but if not, I'm just 22 years, and I am young, I need to learn a lot, and I think maybe I can, I don't know how you say, improve with the most years, so I prefer to stay calm. And with the feet in the, I don't know, in Spanish you say con los pies en la tierra. So stay calm.
Well, Dave, an extraordinary performance from Egan. I mean, we knew how good he was, but, well, once he showed other sides of his talent on his Paris-Nice.
Yeah, he certainly did. I think Luke Rowe summed it up, really, you know. I don't think he'd ever ridden in the crosswinds like that before. And the morning of the first day, he was asking Luke about echelons, what should he do, where should he position himself, and there he was. And I think, as Luke summed up later, you know, sometimes you've either got it or you haven't. And it was very, very impressive first few days by him and the rest of the team, and Luke as well, let's face it, Michael. But Luke was outstanding, I think. But it was great to see, and then I thought also think that further down the line, he also backed that up with a terrific time trial, mm-hmm. Which was a real confirmation, really, of his time trial, and I'm sure he can progress further. And you know, I think he in the mountains and on the hills, I think we know what he can do there. So it's been an exceptional week for him.
What's it with Paris-Nice and Team Sky? I mean, you're often portrayed as a team that, you know, it's all about Le Tour, but it's also about Paris-Nice, obviously.
Well, I think we're like ASO races. I think that's what I'd sum up. Add the Dauphiné in, and I think you know, over the last few years, I think when you add those three races up and you know, the total number of wins that we've had in those three races, I think it's we've been pretty successful in their races. So you know, it's a race that we like. I think, you know, Paris-Nice is one of the all-time greats, isn't it, in terms of the race this type of season. There's been one, you know, just have to look at the people who won it in the past. It's a big race, and I think I like it because it is, it's you know, the end of Paris-Nice nearly every year, the guys have ridden Paris-Nice, they're tired because it's a really hard race. You've got all the elements. You've got the crosswinds, the climbing, the time trial. It's, you know, it's a very, very, it's a nervous race, you know, like it was this year. Very, very stressful, very nervous race. And the guys are always really, really tired at the end, which kind of shows the level of the race that it is.
You mentioned Luke Rowe. I mean, it's quite an excitement in Britain and Wales and everywhere about his chances in the classic, and especially Paris-Roubaix, that we know he likes that classic. What do you think we can expect from Luke this year?
Well, I think he started the season really well, and I think obviously he didn't have the injury that he had last year. You know, he was coming back from that horrendous injury that he had. And he came back really quickly, actually. So I think he was probably a little bit, you know, hadn't had the depth of training through last winter. But I think now he's built up, and he's in a very good position now. And I think the thing about Luke is when you watch how Luke rides, he's not like all brute strength. It's not just get on the front and use his horsepower and just, you know, like I say, brute strength. He's got a lot of racecraft. He knows when to push on the front. He can read the race well. He knows when to hold the lads back a little bit. So it's done with, you know, it's done with a lot of technical and tactical awareness, the way that he rides and allows himself to get in the situations and do what he does. And I think that's probably one of his greatest attributes, really. And so if he can use that for his own benefit in the classics, then it'll be quite exciting for him.
Interesting you mentioned Chris Froome there and Paris-Nice. Just looking on my list here, he's never ridden Paris-Nice. He's always preferred to start elsewhere. A couple of times he's ridden Tirreno-Adriatico, but Paris-Nice has not been on Chris Froome's menu.
Interesting the point that Dave Brailsford made there about them liking ASO races. The record's pretty good in other stage races as well, Romandy and places like that, but they do, and certainly Paris-Nice and the Dauphiné have a record that's second to none. And it was just an interesting point to make, this, you know, this suggestion almost that there's a formula that ASO have for their races that suits Sky. I just thought the fact that he made that point a couple of times was quite interesting.
Quite a few other talking points and stories from Paris-Nice. Sam Bennett, Ireland's sprinter, riding for Bora Hansgrohe, won a couple of stages. The first was stage three in to Moulin, where he beat Caleb Ewan. More impressive, really, was stage six, where he really outmaneuvered everybody, but especially Arno Demar. Two stage wins for Sam Bennett. He's won a stage of everything he's ridden so far this season. And Daniel, just again, thinking back to his interview with you from the Bora Hansgrohe training camp early in the year and his disappointment at not being on the early selection for the Giro d'Italia. And I wonder whether these victories for Bennett are going to force a change of mind. It seems bizarre to have a rider who's capable of winning a couple of times at Paris-Nice and you're not thinking of taking him to the either of the first two Grand Tours.
It's a good question, Lionel. The first question that was raised after that interview in Mallorca, it was before Christmas, wasn't it, in December, was how genuine Bora Hansgrohe were about wanting to give Bennett an opportunity in Milan-San Remo. Now, I don't know how much his form has counted or how much it was always their intention to give him a shot at Milan-San Remo, but it looks as though that's going to be the case. So that's already good news for Sam Bennett. If it does indicate that they are sort of flexible and open-minded, then who knows, there might still be an opportunity for him at the Giro to do the Giro. And I mean, it's got to the point, the way Sam Bennett has started the season, where it would almost be quite embarrassing if Bora were not to select him for any of the three major tours. Certainly when Pascal Ackermann, the German sprinter, who really has kind of superseded Sam Bennett in the Bora pecking order, primarily, we think it's fair to say, because he's German and it's a German team, he's not had the sort of rip-roaring start to the season that some people expected. I mean, he won the Clásico de Almería, but it's been pretty quiet otherwise. That's going to be an interesting one to watch over the next few weeks, especially with, you know, Peter Sagan as well being slightly undercooked at the start of the season. I'm thinking about Liège-Bastogne-Liège and also suffering with illness before Tirreno-Adriatico. So he's not been on the best sprinting form as yet. That was one of the interesting takeaways from Paris-Nice. What did you chaps make of Romain Bardet's performance? Because I saw some grumbles in the French press and on social media about Bardet not being a busted flush. It's a bit early to make sort of pronouncements like that, but it was a slightly disappointing week for him, I would say.
Slightly underwhelming, wasn't it? Especially as he had got himself into a pretty good position after all the crosswind stages. And this last year, the Tour as well, he had a lot of bad luck on the cobbled stage to Roubaix, didn't he? But he rode extremely well. And in the last couple of years, he's ridden well where we've least expected him to ride well, and not perform so well where we expect him to perform well, i.e. in the high mountains. So a bit underwhelming. I mean, there are some surprising performances. I mean, I thought Oliver Nasson was an absolute revelation at Paris-Nice. Extraordinarily strong performance from him, his teammate, of course, at AG2R. We'll talk about Tirreno Adriatico in the next part, but there are riders whose performances thus far have surprised me for not really being what I'd expect.
I was going to say, because Bardet was saying before the race that it wasn't mountainous or hilly enough for him, a bit of a kind of rouleur's edition of Paris-Nice this year. He was so-so in the time trial, wasn't he? And he did okay on the stage to the Col du Torini. But, I mean, that's a tough climb for this time of year, but it's not, you know, there have been tougher climbs in Paris-Nice, I'd say, over the last 10 years. So on the one hand, you know, fifth place was not a bad result for Bardet, especially when you consider his objectives really are at the height of the summer. But then on the other hand, you look at Bernal, you're not quite comparing apples and oranges, are you? But you're comparing kumquats and satsumas a bit. Because Bernal, his season is structured completely differently to Bardet's, and so you look at them, relative to one another, but really they're moving targets in a sense. You're not really comparing like for like, but I would say, you know, a solid week's work for Bardet, and certainly better than a couple of years ago when he got chucked out for holding onto a car trying to close a gap back up to a group. So,
do you not think Kwiatkowski will be disappointed? Do you not think he? I mean, I spoke about him last week, and it seemed that, you know, if he was able to win Paris-Nice, he would have the support of the team to win it, and in the end, didn't quite have it on the climb.
No, but the road decides, doesn't it? And he's not as good as Bernal at climbing. So, you know, the pecking order is set.
I mean,
there.
My main reservations about Kwiatkowski as a 3-week rider are simply that I'm struggling to think of a rider as fast as Kwiatkowski. And, you know, I'm no great expert on physiology, but what you often hear and what I often read is that it's a lot easier to turn someone with or to give someone with slow twitch muscle fibers slightly faster twitch muscle fibers to make them a little bit quicker. And it's quite hard to make someone who is as quick as Kwiatkowski into more of a sort of endurance animal. And that sort of got me thinking about who was the last really quick Tour de France winner, because Kwiatkowski is a rider who can win bunch sprints. And that just says to me that, you know, he can be manipulated and he can be changed and he can be developed up to a point. But to think and suggest that he might be able to tread the same path that Geraint Thomas has trodden might be a bit of a stretch. I don't know.
I actually always thought it was
I was starting to question myself. But the point is about the historical this? Point does hold. I think you know, there haven't been as many riders who have been as punchy and as explosive as Kwiatkowski is, who have excelled or certainly to finish on the podium in the Tour.
Is it something to do with his? Is it something to do with his white blood cells? Tippy tappy.
Plasma. White blood cells. Blood cells.
This is some pretty high cadence backpedaling going on.
Yeah, it is. It is actually.
Other talking points from Paris-Nice, just running through the rest of the stages. An impressive win from Magnus Cort on the day that Kwiatkowski took the yellow jersey. Another very good week all round for Astana, and of course we'll talk about them again in part two when we assess Tirreno Adriatico, but a stage win for Cort and another one on the final day for Jon Izagirre, crossing the line in Nice to win the stage at almost exactly the same time that Jakub Fuglsang was crossing the line, his teammate, to win the stage in Tirreno Adriatico, the scheduling that I was grumbling about at the start. And the other two stories that really leapt out from stage winner's point of view, Daniel Martinez, the Colombian rider with EF Education First, another youngster, 22 years of age, a little bit older than Bernal, and perhaps not had quite the level of high profile success yet, but his stage win on the Col de Turini was really impressive, beating Miguel Angel Lopez into second place. That was the day that Bernal took the leader's jersey, so a real sort of triple whammy for the Colombian riders there. And the other surprise, or the, probably the surprise of the week for me, was Simon Yates winning the time trial stage, 25 kilometre time trial stage, and he took that ahead of Niels Pollitt and Kwiatkowski. What did you make of that? Because Yates, he really sort of rode a reverse split across the week, didn't really look like he was making great efforts in the crosswinds to limit losses. Richard, I think you said that he was aiming for a stage win or two rather than the overall classification. But he was fourth on the Col de Turini and eighth on the final stage. So, you know, clearly form was there.
Well, we're watching Tirreno Adriatico finish at the moment. Lionel and Adam Yates going into that time trial was leading the race. And it just struck me that looking at the two Michelin Scott teams in Italy and France, that the team in France looked to me set up more to go for the overall win. You know, there was Jack Bauer, Esteban Chavez, Jack Haig, Mikel Nieve, Matteo Trentin. The team in Italy was strong enough, but I would say the team in France was a lot stronger for, you know, aiming for GC with Simon Yates. Now, he was caught out in the crosswinds, so that really ended his chance of winning overall. But it's been quite surprising to look at the position that Adam Yates has found himself in Italy, where Simon Yates and in Pyrenees looked like he was kind of having fun a little bit, and the time trial, a surprise and not a surprise. It was very windy, wasn't it? And I don't know if that had a bearing on it, but he's a good time trialist. I mean, surprising for him to win, but he is a strong time trialist.
Well, the wind apparently changed direction, didn't it? Or it certainly the direction of it varied throughout the day, and it was maybe slightly more favourable to Yates when he rode. Without that, I think it would have been an astonishing result. I mean, certainly a very good result, but a very good performance by any measure.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com. with the code SISCP25. That's at scienceandsport.com. This week's question for the Science and Sport experts comes from Dan Deakins, who writes, "For as long as I've been cycling 20 years, I've been underweight. I'm now 24 and 60-ish kilos. I've never struggled with it mentally because it's just who I am, even though I get my skinniness candidly pointed out quite often. I've always had the explanation that I'm a fit cyclist, so it doesn't bother me. I try to ride with intensity at least once a week throughout the year, yet I find my weight or lack of really detrimental in autumn, winter, when the wind picks up. Do you have any tips, both eating and training-wise, for someone like myself who's never been able to put on weight to make training more manageable with the weather conditions over the winter months? Many thanks, Dan Deakins." Over to you, Ben Samuels.
Thanks for the question, Dan. So any changes in body composition are going to be the result of consistency and prioritising specific training and nutrition protocols. In relation to the increases in body mass and potential lean mass that you're looking to achieve in this training block, the starting point will always be a calorie surplus, i.e. taking in additional calories than you are expending in the day. Specific nutrients of interest may then be your daily protein intake. Protein is made up of a number of amino acids that form the basis of new tissue within the body. Your pattern of protein feeding throughout the day can be planned in a way to maximise muscle protein synthesis or the rebuild of new muscle tissue. To do this, you'll be looking for a protein feeding with each main meal of the day and additional feedings post-exercise and pre-bed. Your total daily calorie intake would then be made up of a balance of carbohydrates and fats.
Well, newsflash from Tirreno Adriatico.
We interrupt this programming to bring you a newsflash.
Yeah, well, it's all over, and there's been a real dramatic turnaround in the final time trial, the traditional final time trial in San Benedetto del Tronto. I believe it's a straight out and back, isn't it? 5 kilometres out, turn around and come back again, pretty much. Well, Primoz Roglic, who trailed by 25 seconds before the stage, overhauled Adam Yates to win overall by a single second, so very close at the finish there. The stage was won by Victor Campenaerts of Lotto Soudal. He, of course, is completing his preparations for a tilt at the hour record in Mexico next month. But again, it's been a pretty remarkable week of racing in Tirreno Adriatico with a story every day. The team time trial at the very start, Mitchelton Scott beat Jumbo Visma to put Michael Hepburn into the lead. But probably the most eye-catching incident of the stage was the incident where a pedestrian walked in front of the Bora Hansgrohe team and brought down a couple of the riders, most notably Rafał Majka and Oscar Gatto, provoked quite a severe reaction on social media, particularly people criticising the marshal for not, presumably for not warning the pedestrian. But this is one of the consequences of the smaller races. The Tour de France might well have an entire time trial course barriered off, or actually probably wouldn't, would it? But in a race like Tirreno Adriatico, there isn't the budget to barrier off the entire course, and so there are these outside influences, and unfortunate things do happen. Just a mistake and an unfortunate incident. The rest of the race was aggressive and attacking. De Koenig Quickstep, well, Julian Alaphilippe won a couple of stages, perhaps predictably the uphill finish on stage two, but then he beat the sprinters at their own game on stage six with a really sensational finish which catapults him up the list of potential winners for Milan-San Remo at the weekend. We'll talk about that in the final part. And not to be outdone, Elia Viviani also won a sprint stage for De Koenig Quickstep. But arguably the most impressive performance of the week was Alexei Lutsenko of Astana. He's been red hot so far this spring. Tour of Oman, he won. He's been up there in both Omloop Het Nieuwsblad and Strada Bianca. And on stage four, he survived two crashes, hauled himself back up to the lead group, and then won the finish. Quite a remarkable day. That was also a stage that was notable for the finishing circuit and a little bit of confusion when the bunch basically had to be given a virtual time so that they didn't all run into the breakaway riders and cause a lot more confusion. And as I said, Jakob Fuglsang of Astana won on stage five. So quite a lot to talk about from Tirreno Adriatico, really, especially as everything there particularly sort of points towards Milan-San Remo at the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, Adam Yates, very close to a major win for him after a disappointing season last year, really. He did not have a bad time trial. I was actually quite surprised that Roglic was, 13 seconds down on Campenaerts and 11th on the day. I might have expected something a bit better from him, although maybe it's not quite long enough, that time trial. But, that will be very disappointing, I imagine, for Adam Yates to come so close to winning a race like that. But Roglic is certainly the man in form, isn't he? Another stepping stone for him on the way to the Giro.
Yeah, it's probably, unfortunately, going to be typical of the situation that Adam Yates is going to find himself in numerous stage races in the future, because while he's not a terrible time trialist by any stretch of the imagination, he is someone who is vulnerable when he's leading a race and has to defend the lead in a time trial. Not entirely surprising. The Tour de France this year, as we know, is quite light on time trialing. Yates is targeting that race. That's his main Grand Tour in 2019. So from that point of view, it's not too much of a worry. And he's certainly climbing very well, isn't he? And as you say, Rich, Roglic, not only does he look like the man in form, but he looks like a complete package at the moment. Less of a complete package in some respects at Tirreno than Jakob Fuglsang looked at times. But then we've seen Fuglsang's limits, I think, in the past in major tours. Certainly an incredibly talented rider and a very good all-rounder as well, but notwithstanding Astana's incredible current run of form, I don't think anyone is rushing to sort of put the family chateau on him for the Tour de France.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Harry's. Now, Primoz Roglic had a close shave, or did Adam Yates have the close shave in Tirreno Adriatico today?
I don't think Adam Yates had a close shave for quite a while. That's how you tell them apart, isn't it, Adam and Simon Yates?
Indeed. Well, Harry's Razors have a special offer for Cycling Podcast listeners.
And Adam, if you're listening, Adam Yates.
You can get your trial set for £3.95 by going to harrys.com/cycling. What do you get with your Harry's Razor set? You get your weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, travel blade cover. Richard, you've been shaving with Harry's Razors for a while now.
Yes, Lionel, I'm the only person in the Cycling Podcast family who shaves, I think. And it's become the easiest thing in the world for me because I get my razors delivered now by Harry's. Not only did I get my trial set, which I did about a year ago, but I get a regular delivery of fresh razor blades.
So you've always got a nice new sharp blade.
Nice,
you're not doing
face.
That thing where you've cutting you're using
your
one
face
a few days
and, oh, no,
after it's
no,
gone blunt.
No.
Before
no.
you can go to the shop and get
it's incredible luxury.
Yeah. It sounds
very
it.
Nice razors.
Tempting me to.
Really? Would you?
I might give it a go.
Actually, when I saw Magnus Cort win that stage of Pioneer, he said a bit of Lionel Burney about him with the blonde beard.
Blonde, that's very flattering. Mine's more grey these days.
Grizzly.
Grizzly.
Yeah, Magnus Cort, though, I did think he had a bit of the Lionel Burneys about him.
Well, if you want to be smooth like the buffalo and not grizzled like napalm, you can get shaving today with your Harry's trial set for £3.95. And in doing so, you help support the Cycling Podcast. You can get your trial set delivered to your door with the razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel and travel blade cover. Go to harrys.com/cycling. That's harrys.com/cycling.
You mentioned Lionel, Tirreno Adriatico, sort of, well, and Paris-Nice, they both offer a few clues to what we might expect at Milan-San Remo. Julian Alaphilippe seems to be a lot of people's favourite for Milan-San Remo, but Sam Bennett comes into the reckoning as well, perhaps.
Well, Rich, I make it that Julian Alaphilippe is only the 5th most likely rider to win Milan-San Remo.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is that according to the bookies?
In my ranking.
Oh, is this your ranking? Well, yeah. have you got a top 18 likely winners of Milan San Remo there?
Of course, which will not be. Well, it's only been committed to paper by me. It does not exist. It will not exist in any other form.
Well, people can write it down.
The audio form, which I'm about to deliver it, unless I be completely.
Are you doing it in reverse order?
No, descending order, napalm. So starting with most likely first, I'm going to give just surnames. Sagan, Ewan, Viviani, Gaviria, Alaphilippe, Groenewegen, Christophe Demar, Bennett, Trentin, Kwiatkowski, Van Avermaet, Colbrelli, Mohoric, Gilbert, Wellens, Bettiol, Nibali. There you go, chaps.
Sagan first.
I shall say this. Only once, napalm.
Sagan definitely Sagan came first. And Ewan second Sagan. There. That's interesting.
Well, Sagan's been struggling with illness, some kind of stomach problems, virus, been off, a little way off his best. At Tirreno Adriatico, his best result was 2nd on a stage. He's also 5th. But we normally expect him to be bossing things.
Never write off Sagan. Well, these might be exactly the circumstances in which Sagan finally wins Milan-San Remo.
I think about the circumstances of last year's of Nibali's win last year, and we talk every year, and I drone on about this issue of hesitation in Milan-San Remo, and the only circumstances in which someone can really upset the bunch and get away is if the bunch hesitates, and that certainly happened last year. I see a recipe for that again this year with so many teams, with the smaller team sizes, certainly compared to 2 years ago, so only 7 riders per team. That was definitely a factor last year, and this year there are multiple teams with decisions that they'll have to make quickly on the road, depending on who's feeling better on the day and what the race circumstances are. I'm thinking of UAE Emirates with Gaviria and Christophe. I'm thinking of De Koninck with Alaphilippe, Gilbert and Viviani. I'm thinking of Bora with Sagan and Bennett. And, you know, any moment's hesitation can be seized upon by a sort of would-be opportunist.
Can I ask a question about your list, Daniel? You don't have to read that again, but were there any Astana riders on there?
I left off Magnus Kort. I had Magnus Kort on it, and I did some last minute editing, and an Astana rider
is surely going to win.
I would number 13 on my list was Colbrelli. I will substitute in Magnus Kort, who
this list has so little credibility if you can just rip it up like that. Honestly.
there's a few possible. Magnus Kort, definitely. Lutsenko, why not?
And I think that the teams that will, you know, obviously are most sort of vulnerable and will be most nervous with, you know, going into the race with up against so many different outfits with multiple leaders will be, you know, the likes of Lotto, Sudal, Red Lotto, and Jumbo-Visma, focusing on one sprinter, Groenewegen and Ewan respectively. And they're going to have to really take control of the race, and they're going to have to not get distracted by whatever happens on the Cipressa, whatever happens on the Poggio, because there's no doubt that De Koninck, for example, will fire off Gilbert and or Alaphilippe on the Cipressa and the Poggio. I would say probably Gilbert will make a move on the Cipressa and Alaphilippe will go on the Poggio. And Lotto Soudal and Jumbo-Visma and any other team that is absolutely committed to a bunch sprint is just going to have to stay on the front and keep riding. Groupama FDJ are another team that has a sole objective, a sole captain in Demar, which, you know, can work, but it obviously leaves you vulnerable as well.
Groenewegen wasn't initially in the Jumbo-Visma team for the race. He's brought in to replace Timo Roosen, who's injured. He's never ridden Milan-San Remo before, Groenewegen.
Do you think that's a problem, Napalm? I think we've seen a few times in the past when riders have shocked themselves and everyone else on their first appearance at Milan San Remo. I'm thinking of Mark Cavendish. There've been other sprinters in particular who they almost sometimes seem surprised by how straightforward it is. And then
Gaviria, surely.
Correct, exactly. And in subsequent years, it's almost as though certain riders start to overthink something which was originally quite simple and straightforward. Caleb Ewan last year. I mean, Caleb Ewan's sprint last year suggested that he was going to dominate sprinting for the whole season. He won the sprint for second place so emphatically.
But the thing about Ewan is he may be better equipped to hang on if those climbs are hard than Groenewegen, for example, because we've seen already. And one of the fascinating things about the Adam Blythe interview with Caleb Ewan, which we are releasing this week, I mean, a Caleb Ewan win at Milan San Remo would give us a fantastic opportunity to promote this first interview in a six-part series.
Anyone would think we'd planned it.
Our first interview, Adam Blythe is doing a series of interviews for the Cycling Podcast. First one comes out later this week. It's with Caleb Ewan. And it's really fascinating because we learn about what a versatile rider Caleb Ewan was growing up, and we've seen already this year he can get over climbs, and he's more of an all-rounder than we perhaps give him credit for. I mean, there are tons of interesting nuggets about Caleb Ewan in this interview. I highly recommend it. But you know, if it's the sort of attritional race that does flush out some of the sprinters like Demar, like Groenewegen, even Gaviria, you know, although Gaviria also has the ability to get up hills, then it could be that Caleb Ewan is the fastest of the riders that are left. But Sam Bennett, I think, comes into that category as well.
I mean, the fascinating thing about Milan-San Remo is that it's the only race on the calendar, or only important race on the calendar, for which there's really no directly corresponding testing ground, in the sense that it's not just a bit longer than every other race. It's a hell of a lot longer than any other race. It's... you know, 100 kilometers longer than a lot of other prestigious one-day races. So we don't really know how people are going to react to that, whether they're going to fade, whether they're going to relish that extra distance. And the sprint as well, we expect it to end in a sprint. It usually does end in a sprint. It's completely atypical because there are no lead-out trains left at that point, particularly with seven-man teams. You're going to have one or two men at most.
Yeah, the lead-out trains will be, or lead-out riders or support riders will be doing all of their work on the Cipressa and the Poggio, and then the descent and the little bit before the finale. You're right, Daniel. And we say it every year, but it's a fantastic race because it's Vincenzo Nibali is the defending champion, and yet we're talking about Sam Bennett being a potential winner. You know, certainly somebody who can contest it. It shows the spread of riders that could win depending on the way the race plays out, particularly in the last 50 kilometres. But Daniel, I was interested, you said there Gilbert for De Koenig Quickstep might have a go on the Cipressa, and then Alaphilippe on the Poggio. But do you not think Alaphilippe's best chance is to try a sort of André Schmiel, Filippo Pozzato, Fabian Cancellara type flyer in the final flat kilometre?
It may be, Lionel. I mean, if you think of the kind of effort that an attack on the Poggio demands, he's certainly got that in him. It's a sort of 10, 12, 15 minute all-out effort, depending on where you go. And that's kind of right up his street. But it is an option to go later and to go at the bottom of the Poggio. Again, the bottom of the descent, rather. Again, you're relying on there being indecision in the peloton, which, you know, may well happen. Often, you see riders try to go there, and it's a bit telegraphed because they are the pre-race favourite. We saw that Cancellara succeeded on one occasion, but on several other occasions, he'd gone into the race as the favourite or one of the favourites, and everyone was watching him at that point in the race, and they latched onto his wheel straight away, knowing that he was the most dangerous rider in the world from that range. Would they move that quickly if Alaphilippe was to jump away? They probably would, but that's where the sort of multiple cards that De Koenig have got might come into play. Like I say, I suspect that they'll think the best tactic is to fire someone up the road on the Cipressa and have Alaphilippe sit in, save himself for the Poggio, and then likewise Viviani to sit in on the Poggio as Alaphilippe tries to go up the road and he has to do nothing. But then he's also got to be switched on if Alaphilippe does come back and you know, be ready as he would have been if the bunch had all been together for the last 50 kilometres.
I mean, we're indulging in a lot of speculation here, Lionel. This is unusual, but Milan-San Remo, it's kind of fun to speculate, isn't it? Because the race is so unpredictable. Nobody called Nibali last year. No, I'm not calling. I'm surprised to see him on your list, Daniel, because he's looked a bit out of sorts to me, Nibali, but you just don't know with this race. That's what we kind of like about it, I think.
That's true. It's the exception that proves the rule when it comes to my law about pre-race speculation, because while the possible list of outcomes is huge, the variables are actually quite small, and that's what makes the race, I think, so fascinating. There's only certain amounts of leeway to move in. It's not like the Tour of Flanders where, you know, you could get a big break go away with 50k to go, which has got four potential winners in it. That never happens in Milan-San Remo. It's such a different race in that sense, and that's why it is an absorbing watch, that if you can sit down and watch the last 100 kilometres, you get a real sense of it unfolding. And then, as we've said before, in the finish line, it suddenly all sort of makes sense.
Yep, it's a great race. Really looking forward to it. And we, as I mentioned, we've got a new episode coming this week, the first in a six-part series, Adam Blythe Interviews. And his first subject is his Lotto Soudal teammate, Caleb Ewan. It's a fascinating listen. You'll find it on your usual feed. It'll be released on the Cycling Podcast channel. And looking forward to getting your reaction to that and to the future interviews in this series that will take us through the classics. So do tune into that. That's all for this week. We'll say our thank yous this week to some of the friends of the podcast. If you haven't signed up as a friend, you can do so at thecyclingpodcast.com. Our next friend special, Lionel, is lunch with Patrick Lefebvre.
Or yeah, morning it wasn't quite lunch. It wasn't morning quite coffee. Lunch, but yeah, with the controversial Patrick Lefebvre.
And that's a fascinating listen too. A long story.
I've got quite a lot of context setting to record this week.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And before we go, our thanks very much to some of you who've signed up as friends of the... Well, thanks to all of you who've signed up as friends of the podcast, but I'll name a couple of names. Shona Dunn and Dustin Judas.
Thanks to Eileen Orell and Michael Sheesby.
And thank you very much to William Lindsay and Stuart Raybould.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.